Hello, bring your Bibles with me to Genesis chapter 19. We continue in our study of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. Not a very exciting passage of Scripture to teach because of the content, because of the depth of sin and depravity that is just there in our face. I'm saddened to learn that there are many who would like to just set this aside as mythology or as some kind of a learning lesson and not be convinced that this is actual history preserved for us to learn, preserved for us so that we would move away from the choices that we make in our lives that make the depravity of this possible. I've said this many times as we've gone through this, but apart from the grace of God, there we go and there we are. So we'll see this again in a greater way as we go through this. So as we looked at this beginning in 19:1, we saw God's wrath, verse 1 through 14, God's wrath, the first day. God provides this warning about what is going to come. And so in verses 1 through 14, which we looked at last time, the angels arrive. They tell Lot what is about to happen. He urges them to come to his house and not stay in the city square because he fears what might happen to them. As the angels are in Lot's home in the evening, his home is surrounded by every man of every age from every quarter of the city. And they have gathered as an angry mob crying out for the visitors to come out so they could have their way with them. Lot resists this mob, and the mob turns on him, and they are nearly crushing him to death at the door when the angels reach out, pull him in, and impose a temporary blindness on the mob who are trying to get at them and trying to kill Lot. After they have come into safety, as the mob dissipates, suffering from their temporal blindness, Lot actually goes out and tries to find the two men who would become his sons-in-law to warn them about the coming destruction. And that's as far as we got last time. As we continue in our study of chapter 19, we're going to look at day 2. And day 2 is going to take us from verses 15 down to verse 29. There's going to be three sections we'll look at. Because the length of this, we're going to look at each of these in smaller portions so we don't read through this and spend a lot of time rereading. So day 2, the angels now save Lot. They've rescued him by bringing him in from the angry mob. Now they are going to actually save him. And so what the angels do for Lot and his family is a direct result of the prayers that Abraham has prayed for the assumed righteous individuals in the area of Sodom and Gomorrah. And as we will see later, Lot's salvation is directly attributed to the reality that he is the nephew of Abraham and by extension is a part of those who will be blessed through the life of Abraham. So number one, as we build this part of the outline, the angels urge leaving. Verse 15, when morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away in the punishment of the city." So verse 15 begins with the dawning of a new day. The angels urge Lot to take his family away, his wife and his two daughters, so that they would be spared from the imminent destruction that is going to come to Sodom and the surrounding cities. The angels warned Lot after the failed assault plot the previous night about what was going to happen. He is again warned urgently that they need to leave in order to be spared from the destruction. Well, Lot is going to hesitate. He doesn't do immediately what he is instructed to do like Abraham does. Lot hesitates, verses 16 and 17. But he, Lot, hesitated. So the men seized his hand and the hand of his wife and the hands of his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him, and they brought him out and put him outside the city. When they had brought them outside, one said, "Escape for your life. Do not look behind you, and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains, or you will be swept away." So after seeing what took place on the previous evening, and after having been warned a second time about the imminent destruction that is coming their way, Lot's initial reaction to this urgent warning is to hesitate or to resist leaving the city. It is clear that Sodom has a significant hold on Lot, and he is reluctant to let it go and to leave. So the angels take matters into their own hands. They grab each of the individuals of Lot's family, and they drag them physically out of the periphery of the city. They're no longer suggesting, they're no longer instructing, they are actually taking them out of the city. So once outside the city, the angels again urge them to leave, and they say, escape, don't look back, run to the mountains, or you will die. So this urgent pleading to leave and to escape is repeated some 5 times in this passage, and at each time, Lot resists, or Lot hesitates leaving behind the city of Sodom. The entirety of the city is going to be destroyed, and safety can only be found in the mountains. Now, I don't know about you, but if I had these 2 visitors appear to me and had seen them impose a temporal blindness on an angry mob and tell me that if I don't leave now, that I'm going to be swept away, I don't know that I would hesitate. I don't know that I would dispute what it is they're telling me. I think I would be compelled to trust them and to run, believing that what they have said is actually going to happen. Well, Lot believed this on some level because the previous night he left those who were wandering away from his home and sought out his soon-to-be sons-in-law and warned them of this impending destruction. And yet they thought he was clowning around with them. So here it is the next morning, and the angels again urgently pleading with Lot to leave, and he is reluctant. He doesn't seem to understand that if he doesn't go, he is actually going to die. So number 3 in the outline is Lot bargains now with these individuals, these 2 visitors, verses 18 through 20. He resists leaving and wants to stay in the region, and here's what we read. But Lot said to them, "Oh no, my lords. Now behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have magnified your loving kindness, which you have shown me by saving my life, but I cannot escape to the mountains, for the disaster will overtake me, and I will die. Now behold, this town is near enough to flee to, and it is small. Please let me escape there. Is it not small? That my life may be saved." And so what we see here in verse 18, "Oh no, my lords," captures Lot's sentiment towards this urgent plea to leave Sodom. Lot simply doesn't want to go. He's been warned. He has been saved, rescued from the angry mob. He has been warned. He's been taken out of the city. And here he is saying, "Oh no, my lords, I don't want to go. Is there any way that I can stay? Is there any way that I can be spared and still stay in this region?" And it seems to me that he even flaunts the grace that they've already showed to him and acknowledges to them that he is fearful that he doesn't have enough time, he can't run with enough speed to make it safely to the mountains before the destruction comes. In a sense, Lot is saying, "You've already shown me some grace. Why not show me just a little bit more? Just let me stay. Let me go to this little insignificant town. Certainly you can spare them. It's not that big of a deal, right? It's just a little group of people." This is Lot's way of attempting to manipulate the situation. He fears, at least he says, he fears he won't make it to the mountains. But since the angels are so gracious, certainly they will allow him to flee to this insignificant small town nearby. And therefore he can stay in the region. They can still do whatever it is they want to do. And his life will not be significantly inconvenience by what he's being told they're going to do. So the angels consent to Lot's request to go to this small town, verses 21 and 22. He said to them, "Behold, I grant you this request also, not to overthrow the town not to overthrow the town which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there. Therefore, the name of that town was called Zoar. So perhaps exasperated by and frustrated with Lot's bargaining, this manipulation, they agree to allow him to go to this nearby city, which is eventually named Zoar, which means small city. So most certainly God had already told the two angels that this is what's going to happen, and they simply allow what God had already instructed them to do. They were not making decisions on the fly. Most certainly they knew what was going to happen because God told them what was going to happen, and they allowed Lot to go to this small town Zoar because this is what God allowed them to give Lot approval to do. So the angels instruct Lot to move quickly because they cannot complete their task until he is safely in Zoar. Now, the same thing would be true is they could not complete their task until Lot was safe in the mountains and away from the region that was going to be destroyed. But Lot was fearful. Lot didn't have a lot of faith to trust that they would actually spare his life. And so he attempted to manipulate the grace that was given to him and has bargained to go to the seemingly insignificant town, which is later called Zoar. Now, it's worth noting here in verse 21, the usage of the word overthrow. It is used four times in verses 21 through 29 and is typically used to describe the destruction of the wicked. We see this generally used in Proverbs 12:7. The wicked are overthrown and are no more, but the house of the righteous will stand. And that is the contrast that is being laid out before us through this narrative, is that the wicked are going to be overthrown. And as we've already talked about, the destruction that comes to Sodom and Gomorrah, the fire and the brimstone, is in many ways a foreshadowing of the end time destruction when God will pull the plug on human history as we know it and destroy the earth and then recreate the earth. The wicked will be overthrown here temporarily in Sodom and Gomorrah, eventually for all eternity when the end of time comes. So this word overthrow is generally used to describe the overthrow of the wicked, but the reference is consistently used not only by Moses, but also by Jeremiah and Amos and Solomon as it relates to the overthrow of the wicked of Sodom and Gomorrah. As an example of this, we would see this in Deuteronomy 29:23, as Moses references Sodom and Gomorrah. All its land is brimstone and salt, a burning waste, unsown and unproductive, and no grass grows in it, like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboim, which the Lord overthrew in his anger and in his wrath. So anytime you see that word overthrow in the Old Testament, it is alluding to the overthrow of the wicked, not just the deposing of a king or of a kingdom, but the wickedness being overruled by the holiness and the righteousness of God. So as we continue to go through our outline, let us see God destroys the cities, verses 23 through 26. The sun had risen over the earth when Lot came to Zoar. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground. But his wife from behind him looked back and she became a pillar of salt. A couple things that we're going to highlight here. Number one, destruction is complete. Nothing grows in the valley any longer. It has been reduced to a smoldering heap. It is now overrun with salt, and it is no longer habitable. It is no longer able to be a place where large flocks of livestock would go and feed themselves, which is, by the way, why Lot chose that valley all the way back in Genesis chapter 13. So everything is destroyed. All of Lot's livestock has been destroyed. All of the people have been destroyed. Destruction is complete. There is nothing that remains outside of Zoar and Lot's small family that have made it safely to Zoar. So verse 24 gives a very clear description. The Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah, brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. This is very reminiscent of the Lord's destruction of the world during the time of Noah. The Lord, in meaning out this flood, the Lord opened up the skies and sent rain upon the earth when the floodgates of heaven were opened up. And here God sends fire and brimstone, or burning sulfur, from the heavens to destroy Sodom. It was not a natural disaster, and there are individuals who call themselves Christians and historians who understand that much of this region was ripe with these sulfur areas, who have said this is just a natural phenomenon. There was an earthquake, and the earth opened, and all of the inhabitants of the area were destroyed. Verse 24 sets that notion to rest. The Lord sent fire and brimstone, the Lord out of heaven. This was divine wrath. It was divine judgment. It was God's prerogative in overthrowing this incredibly wicked area, who God said of them, their sin is exceedingly grave. So Lot's wife is also killed as a part of this destruction. This is the only mention of her, and she's not given a name, she's not given an origin. She basically disappears through the rest of the Old Testament, although she comes back as an example in the New Testament. We're going to look at that in just a second. It's assumed by most that Lot had actually married this woman, who was a Sodomite, when he arrived back in the region of Sodom many, many years before. We aren't really told any specifics about this individual or about their marriage. If this is accurate, Sodom was truly home to Lot's wife, and she held a greater affection for it than Lot actually had for himself. So verse 26 describes Lot's wife as looking back and then becoming a pillar of salt. Well, in the Hebrew, the text means something different from Lot's wife just running away and looking back over her shoulder. In the Hebrew text, to look back means to stop and to approach and to lovingly gaze upon that which is being left behind, which results in a refusal to actually leave. Now, some would say, well, you're adding a lot to the text. Well, I am, because that's a part of what the text means when it says she looked back. By the way, this is the exact warning that the angels gave. It is to flee, it is to not look back, indicating looking back with a love for or an affection for that which you are leaving behind. This, by the way, is exactly how Jesus described the meaning of this passage when he used it as an object lesson in his teaching. So when Jesus was before the people, and as it's recorded in the Gospel of Luke, you have the Sermon on the Mount, and this passage is called the Sermon on the Level, which is not on the mountaintop, but it is down on level ground. And it is in this section of teaching where Jesus is talking about his second coming, about the end of history as we know it, how he would come when no one was expecting it, and how destruction would follow his coming. And those who are willing to leave their life behind for Christ, and their desire to keep their life and thereby rejecting Christ, those would be destroyed in the eventual end time that would come as a part of his second coming. So reading together out of Luke chapter 17, here's what Jesus used as an object lesson to Lot's wife's death as it relates to the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. It will be just the same on that day the Son of Man is revealed. On that day, the one who is on the housetop and whose goods are in the house must not go down to take them out. And likewise, the one who is in the field must not turn back. Remember Lot's wife. Whoever seeks to keep his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life will preserve it. I tell you, on that night there will be two in one bed. One will be taken and the other will be left behind. So Jesus uses the death of Lot's wife as an object lesson, talking about how he is going to come when no one expects it. So all the people in Sodom and Gomorrah, they arise for the new day. They're out plowing and reaping, and they're buying and they're selling, and they're doing everything just like they would on any other ordinary day. And out of nowhere comes this massive destruction, this time when they least expected it, much like the coming of the Son of Man. And here Lot's wife has stopped fleeing from Sodom and is lovingly and affectionately looking back. She is unwilling to leave, and she longs for that which she is now beginning to leave behind. So those who look at Christ and acknowledge He is who He says He is, He will do what He says He will do, but you know, I'm just not ready to let go and love Him. I want to cling to the world, and I want to live my life. I don't want to lose it for the sake of Christ. And those are the individuals who reject Him and who will be destroyed at the end of time. This is exactly the object lesson that Jesus used in teaching about the end times, how it will become sudden, and how those who are willing to leave this world for Him would be swept away just like Lot's wife. So Sodom had a grip on Lot, and he resisted leaving, but Sodom had captured the heart of Lot's wife, and she stopped in her fleeing and lovingly looked back in a refusal to leave. And in this moment, she becomes a pillar of salt, immobilized as she gazed at home, and was eventually killed when destruction came. So I think I have seen this event pictorialized in motion pictures. And Lot's wife is just running, and she glances back and becomes a pillar of salt, and that's not the idea at all. She has stopped. She is looking back. She is affectionately loving that place. And the result of that is she is swept away because she's unwilling to leave. So as we continue in the outline here, letter D, Abraham witnesses the result. Verses 27 through 27 to 29. But before we get there, if you remember, when Abraham hosted God and the two angels, and before they left him, he gathered at this point and looked down on the valley. This is the same point that Abraham has now returned to here. This is probably the third day, the day after the destruction. So verses 27 to 29. Now Abraham arose early in the morning, and he went to the place where he had stood before the Lord. And he looked down toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the valley. And he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land ascended like the smoke of a furnace. Thus it came about when God destroyed the cities of the valley that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow when he overthrew the cities in which Lot lived. So Abraham returned to the place where he stood with the Lord and the two angels just 2 days before. And now he looks down at the valley and he sees the result of the destruction. The land was smoking like a furnace emits its smoke. I cannot imagine the pit that would have been in the stomach of Abraham as he saw the reality of the destruction of the Lord. As I've thought about that, I think about times of war, when you see pictures, especially of World War II, when there were massive aerial bombing campaigns, and the cities were just totally decimated, and the next day the fires are still burning, and the smoke is still ascending into the skies, and this is what Abraham sees when he looks down upon the valley of Sodom and Gomorrah. Now it's worth noting that it is the entirety of this valley that has been destroyed. Not just Sodom, not just Gomorrah, not just the cities of that region, but the entirety of that city. I did not figure out the square acreage of that, but it was a big, big area of land that was destroyed as a part of its inclusion in the region of Sodom and Gomorrah. So destruction was complete and the land was totally destroyed. And then verse 29 is a capstone to this section. It attributes the grace that was extended to Lot being the result of Abraham, not only his prayers, but because Abraham is the uncle of Lot himself. So the blessing that comes to all the nations, all the peoples of the world, is extended to Lot since Lot is the nephew, and this is why God showed the grace to Lot that he did. So, we're going to continue here in chapter 19, and I'm going to go through a very brief summary. It doesn't need a lot of detailed explanation. An incredibly sad and wicked part of biblical narrative and history. But number 18 in our outline, Lot is defiled. So these final nine verses of chapter 19 conclude the story of Lot. We're not told of his death. He's not mentioned again anywhere in the Old Testament outside of this phrase, the descendants of Lot. We will see that even though Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed, they are recreated through the daughters of Lot. If you remember, when God destroyed the flood and Noah and his three sons came out, it wasn't long before the prior wickedness of the world was recreated through the descendants of Noah. In the exact same way, the wickedness of Sodom and Gomorrah is going to be recreated through the daughters of Lot. The first thing that we see here, number one, is Lot leaves Zoar. Verse 30. Lot went up from Zoar and stayed in the mountains and his two daughters with him, for he was afraid to stay in Zoar, and he stayed in a cave, he and his two daughters. So the fear that gripped Lot when he was still in Sodom has gripped him again in Zoar, which means he has no faith in him being safe in that region. Coming to himself, his own plan, he decides it's better for him to leave Zoar and now to go to the mountains. And he does that. He takes his two daughters with him, and he apparently is set up home in a cave. We aren't told how long he stays in Zoar. We don't have any idea how long the continuation of his life in the cave takes before what we read about actually happens. But I would imagine it's sometime because of the mention of wine, the need to actually fruit juice fermented so that it can become wine. We don't know if they go down to Zoar and shop. We don't have any idea. There's a lot of gaps we have to fill in. There's a lot of speculation here. But Lot leaves Zoar and his daughters create a plan. Verses 31 and 32. Then the firstborn said to the younger, "Our father is old, and there is not a man on earth to come into us after the manner of the earth. Come, let us make our father drink wine, and let us lie with him that we may preserve our family through our fathers." So remember, both girls were engaged when they were still in Sodom. Their betrothed were killed as a part of the destruction. They're now living life in a cave, which certainly can't be very enjoyable. And so in their own thinking, they fear they will never be able to have children. They will never be able to carry on the family name. And so they devise a plan to be impregnated by their father. They want to perpetuate the family line. And so incest isn't that big of a deal, is it? I mean, why not? That's the thinking of Sodom and Gomorrah. That's the kind of immorality that is common in Sodom and Gomorrah. The sexual immorality of Sodom lives on in the hearts and in the minds of Lot's two daughters. It is difficult to find in any ancient culture the approval of incest. In fact, in some of the most wicked ancient cultures that history knows about, Near Eastern cultures, the Mesopotamians and the Hittites and other cultures of this era and of this land, incest was strictly forbidden, and the practice almost always imposed a penalty of death upon it, as later Israel would also do. The wickedness that seems almost second nature to the daughters of Lot is almost nowhere to be found in ancient culture. But for these girls, it seemed like the only option and a reasonable one to carry on the family name. Let's get our father drunk and let's sleep with him and get pregnant and have kids. What could possibly go wrong, right? Number three, Lot participates. Now, this is verses 33 through 36, and this isn't very apparent in what we read, but I'll make some explanation. Verse 33, so they made their father drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father, and he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. On the following day, the firstborn said to the younger, behold, I lay last night with my father. Let us make him drink wine tonight also, that you may go in and lie with him, that we may preserve our family through our father. So they made their father drink wine that night also, and the younger arose and lay with him, and he did not know when she lay down or when she arose. Thus, both the daughters of Lot were with child by their father. Every time I read this, I just get the willies. I just can't imagine thinking that such a thing was acceptable, that was actually okay to do, that this is where life has devolved in the hearts of these two girls. So upon reading this dark and despicable story here in Genesis 19, it's easy for us to assume that Lot was innocent and unaware of what was going on. After all, verse 33 and 35 say that Lot didn't know when the girls lay down or when they got up. While it is true that Lot knew nothing of the plan, and while the passage implies that he got drunk, Lot was not unconscious and passed out when this took place. Unconscious men cannot do what Lot did. Lot was so drunk that he was unaware that he was actually lying down with his daughters. Today we would call that being blackout drunk, meaning we are awake, but we don't remember what we actually did. Drunk people that commit crimes are still legally liable for what they do, and the same is true for Lot. This is not a commentary on drunkenness. This is commentary on the total depravity of the heart of man. All the way back prior to the flood, the heart of man is set on evil continually, and even flooding the earth and starting over did not change that. Even destroying the excessively evil people of Sodom and Gomorrah did not change that reality. Although Lot was not a part of the plan, he is not an innocent bystander. He participates in it. Well, this is the end of the story of Lot, and we don't know what he thought or what he might have said when his daughters turn up pregnant 9 months down the road. Perhaps he thought it happened while they were still in Sodom. Perhaps he thought they had made a trip down to Zoar. We really don't know. That information is not supplied for us. But the reality is that Lot impregnates his daughters, and they each give birth to a son. Number four in the outline, Lot's descendants. Verse 37 and 38, the firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab, and he is the father of the Moabites to this day. As for the younger, she also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ami. He is the father of the sons of Ammon to this day. Now, remembering that Moses is likely writing this during the wilderness wanderings, and they are going to encounter this people once they enter into the land of promise. So here's what's indicative of what has taken place. The name Moab means from my father. Not even trying to hide what happened. Not even trying to sugarcoat it. Moab, from my father. Ben-Amin means from my kinsman. Not kinsman plural, but from my kinsman. The Moabites and the Ammonites are a people who have been who have descended from this incestual relationship between Lot and his two daughters. They are mentioned frequently throughout the Bible. Now, what is most surprising to me is that even though the sons, Moab and Ben-Ammi, who become the Moabites and the Ammonites in Israel's history in the Old Testament narrative, they were given a land of inheritance by the Lord. Shocking, isn't it? And the reason is because this descendancy from Lot still has a connection back to Abraham. And because of that connection, God in His infinite wisdom, and for reasons we could never understand or explain, allows them to share in the inheritance of the promised land. So when God gives the instructions to Israel, who is about to march into the land of promise, He tells them the Moabites and the Ammonites are off limits. Deuteronomy chapter 2, verse 9 and 19. Then the Lord said to me, Moses, do not harass Moab nor provoke them to war, for I will not give you any of their land as a possession, because I have given it to Ar, to the sons of Lot, as a possession. Likewise, in verse 19, when you come opposite the sons of Ammon, do not harass them nor provoke them, for I will not give you any of the land of the sons of Ammon as a possession, because I have given it to the sons of Lot as a possession. Because of their origin, they were forbidden to enter into the holy assembly of the Lord, Deuteronomy 2, 23, 2 and 3. No one of illegitimate birth shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of his descendants, even to the tenth generation, shall enter the assembly of the Lord. Not Ammonite or Moabite shall enter the assembly of the Lord. None of their descendants, even to the tenth generation, shall ever enter the assembly of the Lord. Now, the tenth generation is not a literal accounting of the generations. 10 is often a number which means perfection or completion, which means in perpetuity, no Moabite, no Ammonite would ever enter the assembly of the Lord. His holiness would not be defiled in that way, even though in His graciousness He allowed them to share or to maintain a possession of the land of promise that Israel would eventually overtake. Now, later in Israel's history, hostility between Israel and the Moabites and the Ammonites would come about because of the way they mistreated the nation of Israel. This eventually would end in God's denouncement of them, and Zephaniah would speak of this in Zephaniah 2, 8, and 9. I have heard the taunting of Moab and the revilings of the sons of Ammon with which they have taunted my people and become arrogant against their territory. Therefore, as I live, declares the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, surely Moab will be like Sodom and the sons of Ammon like Gomorrah, a place possessed by nettles and salt pits and a perpetual desolation. The remnant of my people will plunder them, and the remainder of my nation will inherit them. And that is exactly what ended up happening. Both were eventually defeated and annihilated by Israel. And so Lot's incest discredited his heritage, whereas Abraham's descendants were marked by the miraculous and the gracious work of God. Miraculous in the way Sarah and Abraham would eventually give birth to Isaac, miraculously installed as they left the nation of Egypt, as they were miraculously sustained through the wilderness wanderings and throughout all of history, and graciously so because the nation of Israel constantly rebelled against His rule. And although they were not like the descendants of Lot, they shared in that rebellion. They shared in that idolatry. Ammon and Moab became centerpieces for Balak, the king, and for the idol Balaam or Baal. And Israel would share in that idolatrous history, and because of that, they were consistently punished by the Lord. They were brought back into proper lifestyle as they were disciplined, as they were punished for their tendency to wander away from Him. So as I look at this sordid history, as I think about the despicable nature of Sodom and Gomorrah, the outcry being great, the sin being exceedingly grave, looking at what transpired through the lives of Lot's daughters, this is an absolute contrast between the lives of the wicked and the life of the righteous, the grace of God towards the righteous, and the wrath of God towards the unrepentant who are unwilling to leave their sinful life behind and to allow Christ to be their Lord and their Savior. As you think about Genesis 19, it's all about the contrast of grace and redemption, of righteousness and wickedness, all of which are the prerogative of God as He chooses to cover us with the love beyond our understanding, with the grace that cannot be exhausted. And what did God's people say in the face of that reality? As I think about Genesis 19, as I said earlier, but for the grace of God, there we go. It's God's grace, God's love, God's mercy, God's righteousness that changes the entirety of our present life history and our eternity. Let's